Case number 22-7044. Alton and Southern Railway Company et al. Versus Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division / IDT Appellant. Mr. Edelman for the appellant, Mr. Monroe for the appellees.
Good morning, Mr. Edelman. Judge Henderson is participating remotely, and just for purposes of running the argument today, I am presiding, even though she is the presiding.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Judge Henderson. I'm Richard Edelman. I'm counsel for the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way Employees Division, IBT. I'm going to start by answering the question the court posed yesterday about whether there's still a live case or controversy in light of Public Law 117-216. We submit there still is a live controversy with respect to the carrier's claim for declaratory judgment, the union's claim for declaratory judgments in the transferred complaints in this case, and the union's counterclaim declaratory judgment against the Soo Line and Delaware Hudson Railroad. We rely on the decision of the United States Supreme Court in Burlington Northern versus BMWE 481 U.S. 429. They are in a unanimous decision in a similar situation. The court held that a dispute arising out of a rail industry bargaining involving the BMWE, in fact, that was resolved after a presidential emergency board and after a congressional enactment was not moot because the issue was capable of repetition yet evading review. In 1986, after an impasse in bargaining between the BMWE and the Main Central Railroad, BMWED went on strike, and later expanded the strike to other carriers. While the legality, the secondary activity was being litigated, before the Supreme Court could rule, the president appointed an emergency board that recommended a resolution, and ultimately Congress adopted a resolution ending the dispute. The Supreme Court said that because the same parties are likely to find themselves in litigation again over the issues before the court, and because such disputes are typically resolved by executive and legislative action, the controversy was one that could be, was capable of repetition yet evading review. And that discussion is at 41 U.S. 436 footnote 4. Based on that decision, we submit the court can grant relief in the form of declaratory judgment on one or more of the parties here. And with respect to the Soo Line,
but not injunctive relief, obviously.
Correct. And with respect to the Soo Line in Delaware and Hudson, the parties are still in bargaining over wages. The bargaining round is not over for them. But we think that BN versus BMWE is dispositive of the case of controversy question posed by the court. And since I have limited time, unless the court has other questions, I'll proceed to the merits.
Thank you, counsel.
BMWE here has challenged the continuing validity of the Atlantic Coastline approach to determining whether and when national bargaining is required under the Railway Labor Act.
But isn't that Atlantic Coastline case undisputed precedent?
Yes, and we recognize that this panel cannot overturn circuit precedent, and we are urging the panel to recommend en banc reconsideration of the Atlantic Coastline. I understand what I'm asking the court to do if I'm just going to briefly emphasize the points I think ought to be considered, whether members of the panel would recommend en banc. Then I'll move on to the counterclaim. We think the Atlantic Coastline test was developed as an objective, flexible, practical test that has applied over the years. We believe it now requires unions to bargain nationally, but if the carriers want to bargain nationally, the union has to bargain nationally. The carriers are free to bargain nationally or not, as they choose. And there are two components to the test. The appropriateness of the issue for national bargaining component, we think, has become meaningless because of a germaneness proviso that has been added in subsequent cases. Subsequent cases have held that when an issue is otherwise inappropriate for national handling, which would be under Atlantic Coastline, but it can potentially become part of the give and take of bargaining over an issue that the railroads want to bargain nationally, then that issue, which is otherwise inappropriate for national bargaining, is required to be bargained nationally based on the carrier's preference. So the proviso, we think, overwhelms the test. The other component of the test is the history of bargaining component has become rigid and really separated from the original consideration in Atlantic Coastline, which is we look at the history to see will one form of bargaining or the other be productive in producing a settlement. But prior participation in national bargaining has become a rigid factor and it effectively determines the outcome and perpetually binds a party to national bargaining because of the choice that happened years ago.
Okay, now, in that vein, did BMWED voluntarily participate in national bargaining? I mean, there were several years, 1999, 2004, 2009, and 2014.
Sure. Well, we were ordered by Judge Hogan in the Alton Southern case to engage in national handling. And so we did in the subsequent rounds. And we tried it, and we felt it wasn't being productive on the issues that we wanted to bargain because we were locked into national bargaining. So, yes, we participated, but we were compelled.
Well, and you were compelled. That case was in the 90s, if I remember.
Yes, it was.
And that was based on a finding of prior practice before proceeding that case.
Yes, right? That's correct.
But it wasn't just that you did so because you were compelled to do so by Judge Hogan. He, applying our precedent, said, well, you know, there is also this history bargaining in this fashion.
Right. Now, I think two elements. One is, as you may know, the railroads have argued we're still bound by that. In fact, they asserted that we were blocked by res judicata because of that decision, that we were still essentially compelled. So that's what we dealt with until we got to this round of bargaining and we sought to do it. We thought it was appropriate after all this time to make an argument to the court that the Atlantic Coastline test ought to be reconsidered.
But Judge Hogan didn't agree with that res judicata part, right?
He did not. Now, last thing I'll sort of say on this point and then move on to the counterclaim is to address one of the main points that the carriers have made, which is that they think that there is not a problem here because the carriers are exercising their right under Section 2/3 to join a coalition or not, whereas the union is being made bargain against the coalition under Section 2/1. We don't think that difference is a meaningful difference, but in any event, the carriers are not merely forcing the union to bargain against the coalition. They are forcing us to engage in national bargaining because theirs is a national coalition. Requiring us to bargain against their national coalition is not only determining who sits across the table, but the nature of bargaining. And the two cannot be separated, we submit. And this was recognized by the Eighth and the Sixth Circuits. And we feel that distinction they're making is not a meaningful difference.
But in Burlington, this court distinguished between issues with respect to your scope of bargaining, as well as related to the designation of representatives. What would you say is kind of the controlling issue here?
Well, I would say that the difference is we are being forced into national bargaining. And I think we would say that we are, that's the difference. And in the Burlington case, the panel said, look, we're bound by that precedent. And so that's why we're, and as old as it may be, we're bound by it. I understand that. Again, I respect the limitations I'm asking for the other consideration. If I may, but if we're going to apply Atlantic Coastline, we think it was error for the district court to dismiss our counterclaim against the Sioux in Delaware and Hudson. They opt to engage in national handling for health and welfare benefits, participated in compelling BMWE to engage in national bargaining, but they then refused to participate in national bargaining over wages. In the recent rounds of bargaining, there have been explicit trade-offs between wages and health and welfare cost sharing. Those two railroads want the benefits of employee increased contributions in health and welfare, but they don't want to pay the wages that come out of the national table. We submit that BMWE is obligated to engage in national handling generally. There's no principal basis for suing DNH to avoid national handling on wages while requiring the union to bargain nationally. Now, the district court said nothing in the Railway Labor Act or Atlantic Coastline prohibits partial participation in national handling. But neither the court nor the carrier cited any authority that said it's permissible to compel a party to participate in national bargaining while only partially participating in national bargaining. And the other point here I'm going to make, and the district court said, well, look, health and welfare issues are an appropriate issue under Atlantic Coastline for national bargaining because there's a national health and welfare plan. But that was the argument that the unions made in the Arasa Sioux case that the Eighth Circuit rejected. As a matter of fact, I argued that case. So we think that that's not a valid basis for that decision.
But I have a couple of questions. One is you started off earlier about perhaps this being en banc review. So tell me how you feel the court deals with that procedure at this juncture, or do we rule and then you request reconsideration depending on how the case comes before en banc review?
Yeah, I think you're going to we have to rule with the Atlantic Coastline in mind. I believe that the panel can recommend to other judges in this court to do this case en banc, or we petition. If we get the decision and there isn't such a recommendation, we would petition for rehearing.
And then the next thing I would ask is, what would you propose the test to be then if you don't agree with Atlantic Coastline?
Sure. In our view, we think that Eighth and Sixth Circuits are right, that the parties have a right to bargain nationally or not. And we think, and if I may, the distinction being made that, well, that then overwhelms the other side's right to designate a representative for bargaining. Because, in other words, and that's what Atlantic Coastline said, right? There's an either-or scenario. But here's the thing. You can participate in national bargaining and not be forced as your choice is represented. For example, the Sioux Line and the Delaware and Hudson, they don't need to designate the National Carriers Conference Committee as their representative. But they can sit at the national bargaining table and represent themselves. So we're not dictating who their representative is for bargaining. We're talking about the forum of bargaining and the subject matter. Are we bargaining over an individual agreement, or are we bargaining over industry-wide issues? So in our view, we think the Eighth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit approach is correct.
Would there need to be more than one particular carrier suggesting local bargaining, you know, with respect to the issues or the parties, as opposed to, I'm just thinking about resources and kind of what we would term as judicial economy. If you just allowed on every issue, the particular carrier to come forward and say, well, we believe this is a local issue, not a national issue.
Well, those resources would be the resources of the parties, mm-hmm. of course, in that instance. And there's nothing, you know, whether a carrier or a union is participating in a coalition or not, they still show up and they still gonna have input. And they're gonna say, I don't agree with this concession, or I don't think we ought to make that proposal, whether they're doing that by themselves or otherwise. But frankly, I don't think that resource issue ought to overcome what we submit are the statutory rights of the parties to bargain in the manner in which they choose to bargain.
Thank you. Judge Henderson, do you have any questions?
No questions. Thank you, Judge.
All right. We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Monroe.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Monroe from the Railroads. I'd like to begin, if I may, with the same place that my friend Mr. Edelman began on the question of mootness. We agree in part with the appellants with respect to the question of mootness. We just come at it, the conclusion is the same. We agree that the case is not moot and the panel can issue a substantive decision on merits. We come at it slightly differently. The way I would analyze the question is with respect to the issues and requests for relief presented in the complaints. As you heard from Mr. Edelman, there are really sort of two aspects to this case. There's the two-third question, and then there's the Atlantic Coastline question. The two-third question is not moot. because that is a persistent question. It continues to affect the relationship, bargaining relationship for the parties, not just in the round that just ended with congressional position, but going forward. It has a material impact on the relationship from this point. And so if I filed a complaint tomorrow, it would be a case or controversy on that issue. With respect to the application of coastline, I believe that issue is moot because it is a fact and round specific inquiry, and there's no relief that the court could grant at this point meaningful to either side with respect to that. So what we would suggest is that the court issue a decision disposing of the two-third question, which we already addressed in the committee, and then dismissing the appeal on coastline, the remaining issues in cases. I do agree with Mr. Edelman that in the event that the court does not agree with that analysis, there is a plausible argument to be made on the capable repetition yet evading review. I would note that this case was dismissed, not this case, but the preceding case, the Alton 1 case, was dismissed by this court on mootness grounds in 1997, I believe it was. And so if the court did so again, you would have a scenario where the same issue with the same parties has been before this court two times and has been dismissed for mootness both times. That seems to me to be a perfect example of something that's capable of repetition that is repeating and yet is evading. Unless there are any questions on that, I can now turn to the merits.
Thank you, counsel.
With respect to the merits questions, if the court does not dispose of anything on mootness, I'd suggest this is a very straightforward case for this panel. You've heard from my friend that they agree Atlantic Coastline is the controlling law. And more important, they did not make a case under the coastline standard in the district court. This record contains evidence that is exclusively favoring the carriers, both with respect to the primary claim and with respect to the counterclaim. It's undisputed. So, you know, they said, well, we did present this under the coastline with respect to the counterclaim. You heard Mr. Edelman refer to their argument that they could win under that issue. But if you look at what they actually argued in the district court and the evidence in the record, what you'll find is that their argument turns on this contention regarding Section 2-3rd, the other issue in the case. They're pointing to the Sixth and Eighth Circuit decisions and saying it's not fair that a carrier like Soo Line gets to choose whether to engage in national handling. It's the phrase that Mr. Edelman repeatedly uses, both in his brief and today. And a union does not get to choose whether to join national handling. That is not an accurate depiction of how this works as a practice. There is no circuit split. There is no inconsistency. Because as we've explained, Section 2-3rd merely provides that both sides, railroads and unions, get to decide whether they want to join a team. It doesn't say anything about whether they have to play against a team. So you can't be forced to play for a coalition, but you can be forced to bargain against them on both sides. The union's argument to the contrary depends on this semantic trick. They keep saying it's about joining national handling. We have to join national handling, but the railroads don't have to join national handling. Well, what does that mean? National handling, as both sides have been using it in this case, is industry jargon for multi-employer collective bargaining, because that's been the historical practice. So when you say join national handling, it means two different things, depending on whether you're a railroad or a union. If you're a railroad, and you have to join national handling, you are surrendering your bargaining autonomy to the group. You are going to be stuck with whatever terms are negotiated for the entire unit. So when he says Soo Line can sit at the table and negotiate for itself, no, it can't. The whole point of national handling is they're going to get the same provisions as everybody else. If you're a union, joining national handling just means you're sitting across the table from a coalition instead of a single railroad. You don't surrender your autonomy. You don't have to make any concessions in your bargaining strategy. You don't have to modify
your priorities to accommodate the rest of the group. There is zero impact on representation, none. That's why this court rejected reliance on Section 230 in General Committee. And Maintenance Away says, well, that case is distinguishable because it was, the union there wasn't trying to bargain at the level of representation. But this court wasn't addressing that question. That's the craft-wide, system-wide bargaining issue. It was not addressed. This court was talking about national versus local handling when it said, quote, Section 230 is not the governing provision. I don't know how this court could have been more clear. But more importantly, for the purposes of counsel's argument, even the other courts, the other circuit courts that have addressed this issue, support our view. The Suline case says both railroads and unions have the right to decide whether to join a coalition. Very expressive. That's why it said Suline can't be forced. It has a choice, just like a union has a choice whether to join a coalition. It then goes on to say, this is it, 891 F2nd 679, if the unions select a single representative, that representative may lawfully insist that the same contract terms be applied to all of the unions. Well, that's exactly what we're saying happens here in multi-employer. In other words, it works the same both ways. There's no inconsistency. Apply this to the counterclaim. In this case, the union's really making a rhetorical point about Section 230, saying it's not fair that these little railroads don't have to participate fully. But again, the reason Suline and DNH don't have to join is because they have a Section 230 right to decide whether they want to be in the coalition. Once that decision is made, then the question of whether union needs to bargain is a coastline question. It's about the history, and it's about the practical appropriateness. And Judge Hogan fully analyzed this decision. He said, look, they've been in national handling for multiple rounds now without objection. And it's practically appropriate because they participate in the national plan and because it works. Union is not here telling you, boy, this the way they do it here with this partial participation is a disaster. We never even agree. Okay? They can't say that. Because it does work.
Did Judge Hogan get this case under some implementation of our related case rule in the district court, or was it just random? There were two cases filed in our district court that I guess they weren't really consolidated, but they were kind of consolidated. And this one that's on appeal was the second, right?
No, Your Honor. My recollection is that the unions filed the four separate cases in other jurisdictions. We then filed the lead case that is now on appeal here and then moved to transfer the other four cases. Those cases were all then subsequently consolidated with this case.
And when you filed the case here in this court, was there some sort of a notice of related case that was filed that linked this case back to the litigation in the 90s, or the just coincidence that Judge Hogan got this?
I honestly do not recall. I'd have to go back and look at the docket.
So I looked at the docket and I didn't see any notice of related case.
If we did not file a notice of related case, then it was just assigned to Judge Hogan under whatever procedures the district court used. It was not a request that we made outside of the docket.
Okay, just curious.
Unless there are any other questions.
Judge Henderson?
No questions, thanks.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Edelman, I believe you were out of time, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. First, to your question, Judge Wilkins, my recollection is the carriers did note it as a related case to the 1994 case, and that's how it ended up in front of Judge Hogan. My recollection is that was the first time I was aware that you could do that with an older case, and so I later did it in a subsequent case. So I'm 90% sure that's what happened. That they did note it as a related case. With respect to the Atlanta Sioux Line and D&H. The other point I want to make is that under the germaneness standard that's been applied, I can't imagine anything more germane to bargaining over health and welfare than wages. The two have been linked in every round of bargaining since I've been practicing here. And certainly that's more related than the work rules issues were in the Burlington Northern case. With respect to what the 8th and 6th Circuit said, the 8th Circuit specifically looked at Atlantic Coastline, said it wasn't convinced, and that says that while Section 2 first requires every reason left to make agreements, the court was, I'm quoting, aware of no decision that construes this duty to obligate the railroad to bargain for a national agreement to a national bargaining representative. The 6th Circuit said, I'm quoting, no court of appeals has compelled national bargaining before the start of negotiations, and that to do so would fly in the teeth of the statute. So both of those courts recognized that bargaining with a national representative puts you into national bargaining, and it's not just a choice of representation. And as to the question Mr. Monroe raised about the Sioux and the D&H, if you're in national bargaining, it doesn't mean they need to sign the agreement that the other carriers in the coalition are there. They're going to be in national bargaining, sitting at the national bargaining table, bargaining. So they're not bound to the choices. They don't have to caucus with them. They don't have to make the same choices. Court doesn't have any other questions. I'll say I appreciate the extra time.
Thank you. And I just know for the record, I asked about the related case issue. I had misread the docket. There was a notice of related case that was filed. I thought that it only included the other cases from the other jurisdictions, but it also listed
the
1994 D.C. District Court case as related cases. So I didn't notice that when I
thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll take the case. Judge Henderson, did you have any questions?
No questions, thanks.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.